Good morning. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to a special Good Friday edition of RN Breakfast.
And I'm Noel Debien. Great to have your company. I hope you'll stay with us right through to 9 o'clock. Everything you've ever wanted to know about the Easter story from Palm Sunday to Easter Day, but have been afraid to ask.
The Easter story has plenty to say about the world in 2016, with its suffering, violence, fear, and hope. In the program this morning, we'll be hearing different views of what the story of Jesus' crucifixion tells us about ourselves and how it informs the experience of women. And we'll also be hearing from Bishop Jeffrey Robinson on how he thinks the Catholic Church might redeem itself over the sexual abuse crisis. And we'll have news at 6:30 a.m. and on the hour until 9 a.m.
Good Friday, the day that Christians around the world remember the suffering, torture and crucifixion of Jesus. And here's a man who was victimized, marginalized, tortured and killed, and whose family and friends were forced to watch the whole thing. It's a story that in different ways features in our news feeds almost every day. In a moment we'll hear from Geoffrey Plant, one of Australia's finest preachers and teachers, and possibly the only Catholic priest in Australia whose sermons are published professionally. He'll be joining us throughout the program to take us through the Easter story on this special RN Breakfast for Good Friday morning.
But first, here's a biblical account of what happened almost 2,000 years ago. It's from Matthew's Gospel on the week leading up to the crucifixion.
Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and at once you will find a donkey tied there with her colt by her. Untie them and bring them to me." A very large crowd spread their cloaks on the road, while others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. The crowds that went ahead of him and those that followed shouted, "Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord! Hosanna in the highest heaven!"
Holy Week begins on Palm or Passion Sunday. Jesus enters the holy city of Jerusalem and people acclaim him. Jesus is entering from one of the eastern gates. He's come from Bethany. Bethany is to the east. But the Roman garrison is stationed at Caesarea, which is further up the coast. And because there are so many pilgrims in Jerusalem at this time of the year, it's the Feast of Passover, several legions are going to come down into Jerusalem to police what could potentially be a very disruptive time if anything gets out of hand. So you could imagine as Jesus is entering the holy city, the Roman garrison from Caesarea is marching down and entering through the west. Two processions entering the holy city of Jerusalem, perhaps even at the same time. We come to Thursday, yesterday. Jesus gathers his disciples together to celebrate a final meal. They gathered to celebrate the Eucharist, and in fact, the four things that happened during liturgy last night were: people gathered. Secondly, they listened to the story again. Then we had the washing of feet. Now, that's one of the things that Jesus did. He got up from table, removed his outer garment, and washed their feet. In that culture and at that time, a very menial task undertaken by a servant or a slave. And Jesus said to them, "Will you call me Lord and Master? And I've washed your feet. You then should wash the feet of each other. I have given you an example that you should follow." Yesterday is sometimes called Maundy Thursday, which comes from the Latin word mandatum, a new commandment, mandatum novum, a new commandment I give to you that you would love one another. The kind of love that he was talking about was a love that manifested itself in a humble service of others.
Gosh, I love the way he gives us that sense of location, Noel. That's Geoffrey Plant and part of his quick guide to Easter. He'll be back in an hour to talk us through the next stage of the Easter story. Well, as he views it, the message is that a good society depends on humility and service to others, not power. But Noel, you speak to someone who says humanity often falls very short of this ideal.
Yes. James Allison, former Dominican friar. He did his theology in Oxford and he went on to do doctoral studies in Brazil in South America. He studied with Archbishop Anthony Fisher, in fact. James has written 7 books, I think, including The Joy of Being Wrong, Original Sin Through Easter Eyes.
Oh, I love that.
Well, James's thinking is very influenced by the work of the French social scientist René Girard. And Girard has a really fascinating theory, I think, of human society. He believes that the Christian ideal of the service idea crashes up against our human hardwiring. He thinks we've got an inherent culture of violence, a human need to scapegoat. I spoke with James Allison from Madrid, where he lives now.
Girard gives an account of how human culture came to birth, how we, very, very highly imitative apes, became so good at imitating each other that we lost the capacity to have instinctual controls to our rivalry.
Well, we know, for example, with chimpanzees or bonobos, when they observe them, there are times when a troop will turn and damage and kill one.
Oh, yes, indeed. The notion of chimps and bonobos being friendly hippies
No.
is no longer tenable.
And by analogy, Girard and others like him said, you know, in terms of anthropology, look at how these other primates are working. Guess what? There seems to be a similarity in the way we imitate too.
Oh, I mean, the difference between us and them is that we are far better imitators. You know, there's no longer alpha males, a silverback who controls the pecking order.
Oh.
Everyone is coming to the point where they're so like each other that once it turns to rivalry, the miracle is that we haven't wiped ourselves out. You know, this is the key question. In the contagion of the all against all, or frenzy, if you like, what we've seen happen time and time again, and we know it works, is that eventually either the group wipes itself out or, mysteriously, they settle on someone whose fault it is. This is what enables there to be the moment of peace and order which the horde of proto-humans wrongly assumes is caused by the one who they've just thrown out, rather than seeing it's that they themselves have caused it by ganging together against that one. The thing about group frenzy is that you don't really need any external factors. I mean, we are perfectly good at working ourselves up about nothing. Any object that people might have been fighting about becomes secondary to the fact of the fight. And you only need to look at any of our political parties and their machinations to see how complete that is.
Well, the Trump stuff at the moment is quite striking, isn't it?
What is really interesting are the reports emerging from the rallies where you do get people who afterwards recognise that they have been swept up by a contagion of desire into doing things that afterwards they're completely shocked to have participated in. And this is the phenomenon that was noticed in the 1930s in Germany. You know, I'm not saying Hitler equals Trump or Trump equals Hitler. I'm saying crowds equal crowds. And they are very dangerous things.
Well, that Nazi period, of course, you end up with the Holocaust, you end up with all sorts of enemies that were identified in that period. And you can go earlier to Russia and the pogroms against the Jews. You could go to the Inquisition. You're a Dominican. Asylum seekers, refugees, seems to me.
I mean, there is scarcely any one of our groupings, whether national or cultural or racial, that has not found some way to police its frontiers at the expense of some rejectable other. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Church insists that we celebrate Holy Week, if you like, is the rather counterintuitive sense that we are staging a lynching to show that we are potential lynchers who are trying to learn what it is to be forgiven for being lynchers so that we never do it again.
Let's just jump back for a moment to René Girard, because he started out life not as a convinced Christian or religious person. He was an intellectual. He ended up in the Académie Française. But he was persuaded back to religion because he saw in Christianity a religious theory or a religious presentation of scapegoating and sacrifice that struck him as, wait a second, this is what I'm seeing in anthropology. I might be persuaded.
Yes, that's exactly right. What he saw was the omnipresence of this scapegoat mechanism, this founding murder, if you like, present throughout societies, and always heavily disguised, precisely because the people involved, it was tremendously important to them that they not see what they were doing, because after all, if you know what you're doing when you scapegoat someone, then you know that you're telling a lie. It's only resolved if you all genuinely believe you've really got the bad guy. So the constant sense in myth and ancient history and archaic religion that something is being covered up and that people are to a certain extent playing a game. What astounded Girard was turning to the Jewish and the Christian texts, discovered exactly the same anthropological facts as were in evidence everywhere else, but told from the one perspective that they could not or should not be able to be told from. That's to say, from the perspective of the one who was being thrown out. We create order at the expense of someone, and then we repeat it. We ritualize it, thereby thinking that we can ward off our own violence, which, of course, we don't very successfully for very long.
And why Christianity different? Why?
Remember very much that Judaism is the beginning of the different, because it's in the Hebrew texts that you start to get exactly this mechanism shown for what it is, that the one being thrown out is in fact innocent or no more guilty than anybody else. This was what I think amazed Girard, was how the old lie was finally brought to light. And that, in a sense, is the most powerful thing about Holy Week, is that we're celebrating someone showing us how deeply involved we are in a lie and how much what we call sacrifice is the religious form of, as it were, a cover-up job.
Catholic theologian James Allison talking about the human propensity for imitative violence, what he calls mimetic violence, and the part it plays in this Easter story as it unfolds. More from James Allison later in the program.
But now, Noel, I can't say time for light relief, because this poem we're about to hear speaks of suffering from the perspective of an ordinary man in the street, a nameless prophet, perhaps.
An Absolutely Ordinary Rainbow by Les Murray. The word goes round Repens. The murmur goes round Lorenzini's. In Tattersall's, men look up from sheets of numbers. The Stock Exchange scribblers forget the chalk in their hands. And men with chalk in their pockets leave the Greek Club. There's a fellow crying in Martin Place. They can't stop him. The traffic in George Street is banked up for half a mile and drained of motion. The crowds are edgy with talk, and more crowds come hurrying. Many run in the back streets, which minutes ago were busy main streets, pointing. There's a fellow weeping down there. No one can stop him. The man we surround, the man no one approaches, simply weeps, and does not cover it. Weeps, not like a child, not like the wind, like a man, and does not declaim it, nor beat his breast, nor even sob very loudly. Yet the dignity of his weeping holds us back from his space, the hollow he makes about him in the midday light, in his pentagram of sorrow. And uniforms back in the crowd who try to seize him stare out at him and feel with amazement, their minds longing for tears as children for a rainbow. Some will say, in the years to come, a halo or force stood around him. There is no such thing. Some will say they were shocked and would have stopped him, but they will not have been there. The fiercest manhood, the toughest reserve, the slickest wit amongst us trembles with silence and burns with unexpected judgments of peace. Some in the concourse scream who thought themselves happy. Only the smallest children and such as look out of paradise come near him and sit at his feet with dogs and dusty pigeons. Ridiculous, says a man near me, and stops his mouth with his hands as if it uttered vomit. And I see a woman, shining, stretch her hand and shake as she receives the gift of weeping. As many as follow her also receive it. And many weep for sheer acceptance, and more refuse to weep for fear of all acceptance. But the weeping man like the earth, requires nothing. The man who weeps ignores us and cries out of his writhen face and ordinary body not words, but grief, not messages, but sorrow hard as the earth, sheer, present as the sea. And when he stops, he simply walks between us, mopping his face with the dignity of one man who has wept, and now has finished weeping. Evading believers, he hurries off down Pitt Street.
An Australian classic read by actor John Turnbull. That man crying alone in Sydney's Martin Place, nobody helping him, and that nameless anxiety and grief that many of us carry, and which is so much a part of the modern human condition. Gosh, Noel, there are lots of resonances there with Easter.
Well, with Martin Place too, when you think about it, that poem suddenly takes on new significance, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, not all Christians are celebrating Easter this week, because for the Orthodox, they only started Lent a week ago or so, and Easter will come up on May 1st. And I think the biggest single community here in Australia would be the Greek Orthodox Christians. Producer Nadia El-Ghouli visited St. Nicholas's Greek Orthodox Church in Marrickville, Sydney. She spoke first to lay preacher Angelo Carantonis.
We've been fasting. It was a continuation from the early church. And the idea of fasting is to make us hungry, eat simply, and concentrate our minds and thoughts to Christ who sacrificed himself for us. We're not fasting as a sacrifice ourselves. We're fasting so that we become hungry for God.
My name is Evangelia. I was born in the Orthodox faith, but I have to admit it was until much later on when God gave me the opportunity to really research and learn what Orthodox is all about. We know what the Orthodox Church tells us, how to fast. However, it is a personal journey. We do what we can, what our health allows us, and with the guidance of our spiritual father. Because at the end of the day, it's not just the type of food we eat that is going to save us. At the end of the day, is the effort and the intention.
My name is Olga Johnson, and I'm a parishioner at St. Nicholas Church in Marrickville.
Now, there are extra services, extra prayer services during this Lent period. Do you go to those?
Yes, I do as much as I can because I work. But whenever I'm not at work, I look at my program and I organise myself because I get a lot out of it. As I said to you before, it's a mystery, but what happens is that you enter and you are enlightened, your heart is moved. You're in the presence of God himself.
There's extra services. There's the apothigma, which is a service every weekday, which is a continued prayer and with forgiveness. And then we have pre-sanctified liturgies. Here at Marrickville, we have them Wednesday and Friday. Some churches only have them once a week. And that's a midweek service for people to come and to strengthen them by taking communion. And on the Friday night, we have another service, which is for the Theotokos, the Mother of God, and we have hymns to her as well. And then on the Sunday morning, we have our normal liturgies.
What happens on Good Friday?
Well, in the Orthodox faith, the day starts from the setting of the sun. So, in other words, Good Friday for us starts on the setting of the sun on Thursday. And on Thursday night, Thursday evening, we have what's called the 12 Gospels. And we will have a procession with Christ coming out crucified on Thursday night, cosmic time, but biblical time, and it's really Friday. And Christ then sits out in the church, and people will come up and worship or venerate the cross and everything else. And then Friday morning, first thing in the morning, we have the hours, the royal hours that are read. And again, we have the hymns and the readings of the crucifixion. Friday afternoon, there's a lot of services. Friday afternoon, we have a beautiful service of the taking down of Christ with Joseph of Arimathea. And we have a white sheet and wrap Jesus off the cross because he's nailed to the cross as we have it here in the Orthodox Church. And you take him down and take him in a white sheet, which sits inside the altar for 40 days until his ascension. And then on Friday night, we have a beautiful epitaphial, which is the funeral service of Christ. And there's beautiful hymns that are sung. And then we do a procession right around the streets as a procession to lead to laying him in the tomb.
Good Friday, it's a day that I do nothing apart from attending the church services in the fast possible way I can and reflect and thank God. And of course, we can't help but shed some tears on that day to see the love that God has for us humans and the opportunities he's giving us.
If Christ hadn't have come and died for us on the cross and resurrected us, death is to be without him. So in doing that, he resurrects us and the whole world. That's how we were created in the beginning, to have a relationship with God himself. Without him, we are darkness. We can't do anything right, really. And the older we get, the more we realize that. And the more we look at the world, the more we see that, quite obviously, around us.
Nadiat El-Ghorli speaking with members of Australia's Greek Orthodox community. And Rachel, did you notice in the news there's the big pan-Orthodox meeting coming up? They were thinking about Constantinople, but it looks like Mount Athos now.
Yes, well, I think the Russians intervened there.
They did, but at least first time in 1,000 years they're all getting together.
Amazing. Noel, what would Easter be without some great music? And I think it's time now for Stephen Watkins from ABC Classic FM's For the God Who Sings, who's just the man to bring it to us. Stephen's guiding us through the music of Easter this whole morning.
When Jesus approaches Jerusalem on a donkey, the people throw out the branches and they hail him as a king, not perhaps knowing quite what that means. And that leads then into the music of what we call Palm Sunday, but is also Passion Sunday. It's the beginning of Holy Week. And the music that is telling that story, I think, most eloquently is that by Orlando Gibbons in England, and it's Hosanna to the Son of David.